it straight down the middle. Then it's
welcome to another edition of For the Good of the Game. Bruce Devlin, I got to tell you, the guest this morning, I'm not sure there's another man on the planet that has made a more profound impact on the professional men's game than our guest this morning.
Well, not only that, but he took some money off me 61 years ago. He and Jack Nicklaus together. That was my introduction to this man who has won two U.S. amateurs, a British amateur, four-time winner on the PGA Tour, and as you said, probably the most significant man involved in the PGA Tour. Second Commissioner Dean Beaman, welcome, and boy, thank you for joining us today.
Great to be with you, Bruce. It's been a long time since I've seen you and talked to you, but this is great old times.
Well, thank you.
Dean, great to have you this morning. And I guess we might as well just start first with your amateur career. And before we get into the details of that, growing up in D.C., I would ask you to perhaps reflect a little bit on that and how you came to learn the game of golf.
I got introduced to the golf by my dad, who was not really a golfer. He'd played a little bit of golf, but both my mother and dad worked. And I'm about 12 or 13 years old, and I had two older brothers. And in order to keep us out of trouble in the summertime, they decided the best thing to do was to join this small country club, Bethesda Country Club, so that we'd have a place to hang out in the summertime and stay out of trouble. So I think it was more to stay out of trouble than it was to learn how to play golf.
Good place to stay out of trouble.
I think that story repeats itself across many of our guests. It seems like everybody sort of related the story of how they came to the game, and invariably it came from their fathers, either caddying for them at an early age or being tabbed by their father to come join them for a game.
Well, I didn't, my first couple of years, I didn't play a great deal. I just sort of fiddled around with it. I really enjoyed playing football. We had, back then, there wasn't junior high school football at all. We had recreational football, and I was on the local team and a pretty good player. Of course, my aspirations were to be a football player, but I was not real small when I was 10, 11, 12 years old, but I didn't grow much after that. So it turns out that as everybody got bigger and I got relatively smaller, there were a lot of people that thought that I wouldn't survive with my interest. So my interest turned to golf.
I would think back in those days, because we're now talking, when you were 7 or so years old, the war was ending, World War II. You're in the D.C. area, the center of politics in America. It had to be an interesting time to grow up in that part of the country.
Yeah, it was. It was in the early 50s when the war was over. The federal government, my dad, following the war and during the war, did work for the federal government. And then he went into working for a private company for public relations. And my mother worked for a magazine. So they were busy. It's interesting, a huge contrast to today, because I can remember starting at the first grade, really, when my mother started to work. School was a little more than a mile away. Didn't have school buses where we were. For us, and we walked to school every day for a mile, and we were sort of on our own till mom and dad got home, starting at the first grade. So much different than it is today. You learned early to either get in trouble or stay out of trouble. And it was, I think, you know, I think the kids matured much earlier because they were on their own and had to, and made a lot of mistakes. I'm not saying I didn't make any mistakes, but you learn by them, hopefully, the right way. So it was a different age.
So tell us a little bit about how your game developed as a young man. At some point, you must have decided to get serious about it, put some time into it. Take us through that.
Well, I did. Started playing. We had a very active club, a very active junior program in the Washington, D.C. area. There's a man by the name of Frank Amott, and he had the most ambitious junior golf program of any place in the country. I can remember during the summer, you almost didn't have enough time to play in all the tournaments that he scheduled. So we had events every week, and of course, living in Maryland, where I did, which is right next to D.C. and Virginia, and pretty close to Baltimore, and not too far away from Richmond. There was a junior tournament in Richmond. There's the D.C. Junior, the Maryland Junior, the Virginia Junior Championship. We had a lot of military bases around. Maybe there were three or four different junior tournaments at military bases. Quantico had a junior tournament. And there was competition from the very beginning. And I was a competitor in football, and that carried over into golf. And I can remember the first tournament I played in, which was a junior golf tournament at Congressional Country Club. And I was 13 years old, my first tournament. I shot 113 at age 13 in my first tournament. And I didn't think that was... I didn't have much fun doing that. I thought I'd have a lot more fun if I could play a little better. So I got off on the wrong foot with a bad score, but I think incentivized me to put in the effort necessary in golf. And I was always a very competitive kid. I had two older brothers that I wanted to, I didn't want to be on my own completely. And they were involved in lots of activities, football and baseball and basketball, things like that. And I was smaller than them. I was the smallest of the three. My oldest brother was about 5'10 or 11, and my second brother was about 5'9 or 5'10. And I was pretty small, and in order to be able to be with them, I had to try harder to be able to compete at their level, and I think that was a very big influence on me in my effort to become a better golfer every day.
Hear that? That's the sound of a walk-off albatross, a two on a par five to win a two-day golf tournament. That shot happened to me, 1 in 600 million odds. Since then, people call me Albie. Now, I've told this story so often, my friends can't take it. I'm pretty sure my wife, next time I tell her, she's going to leave me. So I decided to start a podcast to tell the entire world about it because it deserves it. It's the craziest shot you've never heard of. And guess what? There's tons more stories like this all around golf. And that's what our podcast is all about. Join me and my fellow degenerates, Panda and Shepherd, as we dive into them. Insane bets, crazy what-if scenarios, and all the you-had-to-be-there type moments in golf. Find us wherever you get your podcasts. Did I Tell You About My Albatross?
So who are the major influences on your game at a young man? Were you self-taught, read through the magazines, had a great teacher?
Bethesda Country Club had a golf pro. His name was Harry Grismer. He played in the wintertime in some tour events in Florida. So he was a very good player. We had some really good players around our area. There was an assistant pro at Bethesda Country Club, a gentleman by the name of Gene Aldridge, who sort of took a lot of the juniors under his wing And I would say, and he was an absolute walk in the shadow disciple of Ben Hogan. And I think that had a great deal of influence over me. And as a matter of fact, I didn't break 90 till I was 13 or 14, almost 14. And between that age and age 15, I became almost a scratch player. It took me about a year and a half to get there. Once I really stopped playing football and devoted all my time to golf, my game developed very, very quickly. And they had, of course, back then, doesn't have it anymore, but the JC's had a junior golf tournament, national JC tournament, where you qualified, and wherever it was in the country you went. The USGA had the junior championship. So we traveled as juniors. I can remember going to California to play in the USGA Junior at Los Angeles Country Club. I remember the JC's tournament was in Albuquerque, New Mexico. We went there. I believe we went down to Georgia to play in the JC's tournament. So we traveled. It wasn't just local tournaments we played in. Competition was very high. And I can remember qualifying for the USGA Junior at Chevy Chase Club in Bethesda, Maryland. And I shot, I think, 67, three-putter of the last green, as a matter of fact, and I was national medalist, and that was 1953. And as a result of that, I was 15, I just turned 15, and they had age brackets in those tournaments. That was the Middle Atlantic Junior Championship, which they used the qualifying for the Middle Atlantic Junior for the USGA Junior. So the same event qualified you for those two events. And I was low scorer, I believe low scorer in the country. And that qualified me to go to Tulsa, Oklahoma to play in the USGA Junior there, where I met Jack Nicklaus, actually, for the first time. And we had, as a result of being a national medalist, Ben Hogan was just coming back from winning the British Open after his parade in New York, returning. And he had scheduled an exhibition in Virginia for a brand new golf course in Leesburg, Virginia. And I was chosen to play with him in an exhibition. So I got a chance at age 15 to play with Hogan.
What a thrill. Oh, man.
It was quite something. Funny story about that. You'll love this, Bruce. I didn't have a decent golf bag. Didn't have a decent pair of golf shoes. So a friend of mine, I found named David Shedler, had a brand new pair of FootJoy golf shoes. They were beautiful. Unfortunately, they were about a size and a half too big for me. So I wore three pair of socks and his shoes. And my brother had a wonderful golf bag, and I borrowed his golf bag and played in the exhibition. And interesting, 30 years later, Bruce, as we were opening our golf course in Washington, D.C., the Avenel, TPC at Avenel, we were getting ready to open that golf course. I was in a hotel, and at the desk was a package for me. And David Shedler had kept those shoes.
No.
And delivered that pair of shoes to me 30 years later. And the only problem was that he had been using them for 30 years.
No.
Well, unbelievable. So it was a great thing to think back on that match and play my first at age 15 to play an exhibition with Ben Hogan.
Boy, what a thrill!
And that inspired me. That inspired me to want to play in the U.S. Open. So right about then, I decided I wanted to qualify for the U.S. Open. And a year later, and this is probably will tell you a little bit about how I function as a person and how I look forward. I wanted to qualify for the U.S. Open. Living in Maryland, we don't have great weather in the wintertime. It doesn't get very, very warm to play golf until well into March, into April. So I thought if I could go to Florida and play in a tournament and have a week or two, I could get way ahead of all my competition. So I convinced my mother and dad that I could do that, and I wrote a letter to a lady who ran the golf operation at the Breakers Hotel, a lady named Bessie Finn, who I later on, I'm up here in Maine, she was she was one of the first PGA ladies, PGA operations in the world. Huh. And she then became head of the golf at there. So I wrote her a letter. Can't imagine what I said, but probably, the poor kid from Maryland. And I'd won a few tournaments, and I'd played with Ben Hogan, and couldn't I please get in her tournament? So she invited me. I got an invitation. So now I sprung it on my mother and dad, and I said, hey, I really got an invitation to play in the South Florida Amateur. So I had an uncle and aunt that lived in Fort Lauderdale. The tournament was in Palm Beach. So my mother took off work. We took the family car. My dad had to take the bus to work. But that there was only one hitch. My mother said, hey, listen, your older brother, Dell, is a really good, better player than you are, okay? And if we're going to go down there, he ought to be able to go too. So now I have to write Bessie back and get him an invitation. So I wrote another letter down there, and she invited him and went down there. And it was a big tournament in the wintertime for amateur golf. Florida players, they had a lot of new players to come down from New York to play. I'm thinking of some of the former British amateur champion played in it, so it was quite a field. So I went down there it's in March, so I'm still 16. I'm not 17 yet, and I won the tournament, and came back and then went into the U.S. Open, qualified for the U.S. Open. So that was my first U.S. Open adventure in 1955, where Ben Hogan got beat but Jack Fleck.
Fleck.
Mm. But I had that experience of preparation, and I felt. It really made a big difference in my personal confidence that I had taken the time and effort to go down and get a couple of weeks practice in good weather that gave me the confidence that I was ahead of everybody else and probably played above my head. But I did that, and I qualified for the U.S. Open twice while I was in high school, and learned early on that there was no way to have more preparation than you needed. In golf, if you're going to be a real competitive golfer, there's never enough time to work on all the parts of your game. And I learned very early on that you had to be prepared before you got to the first tee.
Now, Bruce, were you yet a scratch golfer at age 15?
Oh, no, sir. I didn't start playing actually until I was 15. So, my journey in the early days was sort of a little bit like Dean's, although I started a little bit later than him. But After my dad lost his arm in an automobile accident, he wanted somebody to play golf with him, and he said it was me. So, I couldn't play. I didn't play very well, but we had an old Scottish pro at the golf course that I grew up at, and he taught me the basic fundamentals, and I went from somebody that never played golf to a pretty good player in about 2 years. So. Very similar story, really, to Dean, the way he in about 18 months become a very good player.
Well, interesting, Bruce. The one thing that I learned very early is that you had to be prepared, and there was never enough time to practice everything. And when I was a junior in high school, before I qualified for the U.S. Open the first time, I started keeping my own stats.
Doesn't surprise me.
Every shot that I hit on the golf course, whether it was in competition or not, I recorded, and I analyzed that, and I always then worked on the weakest part of my game, and also learned how important your short game is to scoring. It's not necessarily the big drive. I learned early that hitting the fairway was far more important than hitting it a little farther and hitting it in the rough. Of course, that's changed today. But
yeah, it has.
Which we'll get to.
I think that even though I may not have been the most impressive ball striker that people watched, I learned early how to score better, and I beat a lot of players who were a lot better than me in ball striking. But I understood where the scoring came from, and I learned that through keeping my own personal stats, and I started that in high school.
I might say also add here that. Of all of the players that I've ever played golf with, Dean had, I think, as good a short game as anybody that I've ever played golf with. Take a comparison between, arguably one of the greatest players of all time, Jack Nicklaus, who, from a driving standpoint, you stand and watch him hit those towering drives, Dean, back in the early 60s, and then you come along and, you weren't as long as him, but boy, you sure competed.
Yeah, well, I learned early that it was the score, not necessarily how you did it. It was the ultimate score.
The number on the card.
Yeah, and the other thing that I did, and after I learned how important keeping stats were, when I was a senior in high school, and really just starting to play really top flight golf and moving out of the junior tournaments into the amateur tournaments. I started walking off distance. I had a scorecard, and I still have a whole box of scorecards from back in the 50s, the late 50s, and the early 60s, where I walked off the golf course. I knew the distances, and this didn't come about until years later. But I thought I had a huge advantage over everybody I played, because I wasn't guessing at the distance. I knew the distance, and caddies hated the caddy for me, because I required them to go out before we played and find out where the pin was.
So you could get the exact yardage.
You had to get up early and work a couple extra hours to walk the whole golf course before we played, because I wanted to know where the pin was. I wanted to know how far it is from the front of the green to the pin, and from the pin to the back of the green. So I started that back when I was in high school, and of course you know what it is today. Everybody uses a laser or has a book and something like that. But But I did that in high school.
What do you think about these books? That there's some discussion that they may be banned.
Yeah, the books on greens. I don't think they banned the books on distances.
Right.
But we're talking about reading greens, and you still gotta, even if you know how it breaks,
you still gotta hit it.
Yeah, you still gotta hit it. And actually, Bruce, if you look at the stats on the tour, and you look at what the percentage of putts are made from 15 feet, it's not a high percentage from 15 feet of the best players in the world with a book that tells you
exactly
really how it breaks. So the answer is, I don't think that has nearly the influence that other parts of technology that have that come into the game have.
Those 15-footers are a little easier to make when the greens were rolling 9 than 12 or 13, probably, too. Wouldn't you agree?
Yeah. I don't know. I guess I played the first time at the U.S. Open and at the Masters. We played on greens that were 7 and 8 speeds, really. The ruling bodies are keeping the green speeds as high as they are to try to protect par. And I'm not sure that it doesn't take a better stroke to hit a putt with an 8 speed than it does a 12 speed.
Now, Dean, you set a pretty lofty goal for yourself at a fairly early age relative to golf, didn't you?
When I played football, I wanted to be the best running back ever, and when I started playing golf, I wanted to be the best golfer ever. So it was a pretty lofty objective, but everything I did on a day-to-day basis was set at that goal, which is to be the best player in the world.
So you had a very good career for the University of Maryland, 2-time All-American for University of Maryland. You'd also had mentioned qualifying for the U.S. Open twice as a high schooler. I wonder how many kids can say that.
Not very many. I don't think so.
No. Not at all.
I would think that's a pretty small number. But just getting into some of your amateur career, we're fast forwarding now a couple of years. I want to talk a little bit about 1960, because this is an experience that you and Bruce would have shared, and we'll see if we have the sequence right. I think in 60, it might have been Eisenhower Trophy at Marion first, and then U.S. Amateur at St. Louis Country Club after that. Was that the sequence as you remember it, Dean?
I think that the Eisenhower was after the U.S. Amateur.
I agree.
I believe so.
Yeah, it was after.
You better crick Nicholas on that then.
Jack had it all back to front. But, you know, you got to remember now, he's a lot older than Dean and I. Well, he really isn't, but he did get it wrong. It was the amateur first, and we played it in St. Louis, and of course, Dean was the winner. Nicholas and I both got our tails whipped, and we headed back to Columbus, Ohio for a few days, and then we went to Marion a little later that year, and boy, I know Dean played a fabulous tournament up there. But Nicholas that was probably one of the greatest scoring efforts ever by anybody, was Nicholas's score at Marion in 1960 when at the Eisenhower Cup matches.
Yeah, I think he beat everybody by 13 shots or something, Bruce.
Yeah, I know. He was quite remarkable. And I know you finished second too behind him.
Yeah, I did.
And Bruce Devlin finished third individually, so you guys were the top three individuals. Of course, the U.S. won only by a few over Australia, wasn't it, Bruce?
I think they won by about 18 or something.
It was actually 40.
40, was it? Oh, that was really a butt whipping.
Well, Dean, take us through a few of your recollections of the 1960 U.S. Amateur in St. Louis.
Well, I can remember, history wise, that's the golf course where Sam Snead failed to win the U.S. Open. It was a rather tricky golf course, up and downhill, and a few blind shots. And I think probably my ability to hit it in a fairway, and at the same time I don't think anybody else in the field knew the exact distances of everything. Which I did, and as a matter of fact, I used to pace off the distances. But where I lived, there was a football field, and I used to practice my pacing to make sure that my paces were exactly on a yard. So I used to practice on the football field, walking on my pacing. But when you have up and downhill shots, and the exact yardage, and you know the effect of trying to hit a little higher when the green is up, and the effect of it shortens it when it's down, and you combine that with knowing the exact yardage, I had a clear advantage over everybody, because I don't think anybody else had scorecards like I did. But I also could putt a little bit, Bruce.
Oh, I know. I've seen enough of that. You sure were a great putter. Of course, that's obviously as part of the short game, but you managed to beat a very, very good player in the final too.
Bob Gardner. Bob Gardner was in the finals. A metropolitan New York player that played all of those players out on Long Island, and so he was very competitive. Really good player.
I think you also, did you beat Bill Hindman on the way up to the final too?
I might have beaten him there. I remember. I'm not quite sure about that, Bruce. But I did beat. I beat Bill in the finals of the British Amateur in 1959.
Maybe that's what it is. I knew you had beaten him somewhere, so it was at the British Amateur.
Yeah, something interesting about that 60 win. I've been asked by a lot of people what did I do in golf that was the most meaningful to me? And I think winning there at the U.S. Amateur in St. Louis was probably one of my super highlights in my life, because when we went over for the Walker Cup, and we had Nicklaus and Tommy Aaron and Wet Wetlefer and Harvey Ward and I think Bill Campbell and all those players, and I won the British Amateur over there. I think the feeling was that I was probably at the bottom rung of all those players that played in the Walker Cup, yet I won the British Amateur. And it was a feeling that was sort of a fluke. And so when I came back and won the U.S. Amateur the next year,
won the fluke.
I felt that I had dunked the flute.
That's right.
It wasn't something that it was something that was very important to me to make sure I knew how well I could compete. And I hope that put an exclamation point on everybody else that I was somebody to be reckoned with.
That was certainly validation, no question about that. The 1959 British Am win, was it Royal St. George's, where we just had the Open Championship? You must have fond memories of that golf course.
Yes, I do. It was quite a golf course. A lot of blind shots. Again, the measuring off the distances, knowing exactly what I was confronted with, when you had not only the run out of the fairways, but the up and downs and the wind, knowing exactly what you're dealing with is a big advantage.
Dean, I got to ask you a question about that, knowing exactly the yardage. Were you ever one of the players that used to go to the edge of the fairway and right in the first cut of rough and take your spikes and rake a little foot-long area where you used to step from? Or where did you find your point? I know, you know, it could have been trees or something, but sometimes, like at St. Ross and George's, there are no trees. So how did you find your point?
Mostly sprinkler heads, Bruce, was what I dealt with. Most courses we played had 150-yard markers to the middle of the green, and there were usually some trees or a sprinkler head. You have to find something. At Royal St. George's, my recollection is the bunkers were the biggest thing. There are 110 bunkers out there.
Right.
You could mark either at the front or the back of one of the bunkers and find almost the exact yardage.
Gotcha. Yeah, it'd be interesting for the people to understand how, you know, you were definitely one of the first. And the very first time that I saw anybody doing that was with you and Jack, to be quite honest. Jack picked up on your way of measuring too.
Well, Jack was, you know, a lot of players used to scoff at it, and Jack was one of them. But we played a lot of practice rounds together, and in the amateur at Pebble Beach, I guess it was, Jack and I played together out there. And practiced a lot together. That was the first time I believe he used the yardages, and he just walked away with it.
Yeah.
You mentioned players scoffing at that at the time. Probably not much different than the players scoffing at Gary Player for his fitness routine.
Well, that's right. Yes, indeed. Yes, indeed. Well, when I went on tour, I had my caddy. I bought my caddy a car, and I had exercise equipment in the car. He drove it for me, and so I worked out all the time from an early age.
Interesting.
That's something maybe many people don't know.
No, absolutely not.
Reminds me of the story of Bruce Litsky, who, you know, has always had the reputation as sort of laissez-faire as it relates to practice and more family-oriented, and played golf when he needed to. And there was a story of him practicing next to someone who shall remain nameless on a tee for a while. And he made that guy promise never to share with anybody that he was actually out there practicing.
Yeah.
Just our little secret. So, Dean, you had quite a few individual championships. You were a four-time winner of the Eastern Amateur, won the Trans-Mississippi Amateur in 60, the Porter Cup champion, Niagara Falls, 1964. Of course, two-time winner of the USAM. Actually, I believe lost in a playoff, didn't you, one year as well in the U.S. Amateur?
Yes, I lost in a playoff. That was probably the best I ever played under the circumstances at Marion in 66. I was literally disabled. I had injured my right hand in practicing that in back in 1963. So I had been literally for 3 years wearing a cast on my right hand, a removable cast. So I didn't use my right hand for anything except playing golf. And I was restricted to hitting maybe 25 or 30 practice shots or else I couldn't play. And I could only play in three or four events a year because my hand kept swelling and the tendons were damaged. And I could not hit a bunker shot. I didn't get in very many bunkers because I hit it so straight, but I could not flex my right wrist, and I couldn't hit it very far at all. And I wasn't very long anyway. And once I injured my hand, but I played my first round that was a metal play. I remember my first round at Marion, I hit 18 fairways and 18 greens and shot, I think, 67 or 66 in my first round. But I'd never gotten any bunkers. And I put it in a bunker on 17 and made bogey. And I put it in another bunker at 18, made double bogey. And then lost in the playoff. So I had a couple shot lead going into the last two holes and blew it because I put it in the bunker.
Mm. Well, you also had probably a lot of fun with several team events, being a participant in the Walker Cup in 59, 61, 63, 65, the Eisenhower Trophy at least four different years, the America's Cup, which was a team event as well back then. What were some of your favorite memories of the team events?
Well, actually, my biggest memory is a joke, really. We're playing in the America's Cup, and Jack Nicklaus and I are partners. And we're in the afternoon round playing against, I'm trying to remember the players, but anyway, we get to the fifth hole. It's a par five hole, and I hit it off the tee. Not very far, and then Jack hit a big three wood or something up, and we were about 80 yards from the pin, and I'm looking down at the ball, and Jack's wondering what the heck is wrong. Why aren't you, you know, it's a pretty simple little shot, and he turns around to me and says, "You know, Dean, it's only a wedge shot," and I said, "Yes," but I said, "It's not Charlie Coe's web shot." He said, "What do you mean?" What? After we played the first round, went in for lunch, and the caddies had the things, and they cleaned the clubs. Somebody put Charlie Coe's wedge in my bag, and I had 15 clubs. So we go.
Oh, boy.
We walked to the fifth hole. Four down to both players, America. And I think we ended up beating one of the players and one of them and tying the other one after being four down after four holes.
Oh, boy.
But it was, I can always remember today, Jack saying, "It's only a wedge shot." I said, "Yeah, but it's not Charlie Coe's wedge." Back then, he had a McGregor club, and I used McGregor, and Jack did, and so Charlie Coe. And you had your name on it was on the back of the club, so I knew it was Charlie Coe's.
That's something.
You know, a couple of your Walker Cup experiences early on, the first couple of 1959 at Muirfield, which was a win for the team, and then 61 at Seattle Country Club. You had, I think, singles wins both years over a guy that you probably would have had a lot of interaction with later in your career, and that was Sir Michael Bonalek.
Right, yeah, Michael got a chance to play him a couple times in competition, and he was a good player and quite a guy, and a very keen competitor.
And I assume there would have been some overlap between your days as commissioner and his days as secretary of the RNA.
Yeah, there were, but we didn't have too much interaction. You know, I used to go to the British Open. And he used to come over to the U.S. Open and the Players Championship, so we did have some interaction. But he was a good friend, and I went over to play in Scotland with my wife Judy to play golf several times, and we played some golf together.
So early on in your amateur career, before you turned professional, I suppose you must have had a day job as well.
Yes, I was in the insurance business. I started my whole life early, competitive golf as well as living. And while I was going to the University of Maryland in school, I got in the insurance business and formed a partnership with a good golfer named Billy Bupert, who was a fine amateur golfer. And we were in business together for several years in the insurance business.
So looking ahead then to turning professional, you had a pretty good tour qualifying school class in 1967, didn't you? Some fine players came out of that qualifying school.
Yes. I'm trying to think of the, you know, maybe Tony Jacklin and Bob Murphy and Cerruto and Lee Elder, I think, Orville Moody. So we, you know, we clearly had a bunch of good players then. That qualified us that we became a voting member. That qualified us to go and try to get in the tournament on Monday qualifying. That's what it got us.
Right.
Thank you for listening to another episode of For the Good of the Game. And please, wherever you listen to your podcast on Apple and Spotify, if you like what you hear, please subscribe, spread the word, and tell your friends. Until we tee it up again, for the good of the game, so long, everybody.
It went smack down the fairway. Then it started to slice just smidge off line. It headed for two, but it bounced off nine. My caddy says, long as you're still in the state, you're okay. Yes, it went straight down the middle, quite a way.